Accession number 30270, reel 1.
Acting Sergeant Elder, reel 1.
Can you tell me if there is a tradition of military service in your family background?
To some extent, yes, because my father was in the army in the First World War and fought with the Liverpool Scottish. I believe that he volunteered fairly early on during the war for it, and he fought on the Somme and was injured there and bleeded out, had the post-war flu during the dreadful epidemic in 1918, I think, and was offered an instructorship in the services, but preferred to return to civilian life. So there we are.
What did he do in civil life?
He worked... He worked in a timber firm in Liverpool, and he became a commercial traveller, and in course of time made an extensive network of contacts and friends, and became a success story within that field, so much so that when he retired he was poached by an alternative firm in Liverpool and continued until he was, I believe, 75.
When were you born?
The 7th of September, 1925.
That means that while you were growing up, things were happening in Europe. Can you remember when it was that you first thought that there might be another war?
Approximately, yes. Near enough, I hope, to be slightly useful. It would have been as we were approaching the Munich crisis, when I became extremely aware of a sense that the clouds were gathering and that Chamberlain's policy was probably mistaken, even though I was only a schoolboy at the time.
Did you have any ideas or expectations about ways in which the war might be fought at that stage?
No, I was too young, really. I was only, after all, 13 when it broke out, I think. Is that right?
Well, if you were born in 1925... You were about 14 at the time.
That's right, that's what I was.
While you were at school, did you do any sort of military or paramilitary training?
Oh, only to a very small degree. I did attach myself to the Air Training Corps briefly, I think. Yes, I did. But it wasn't very demanding and it didn't last very long.
So you yourself had no military intentions?
No, not at all. Not at all.
What were you thinking of doing with yourself when you left school?
Well, of course, everything was dominated by the war. When I left school, I went to Oxford on a scholarship in 1942, but I was only 17 when I went there, and I had, I think it was 4 terms in Oxford, doing a wartime degree, as it was then, and then I was called up in December 1943.
I was going to ask you, what was your first contact with the armed services?
Well, it would have been certainly, for all practical purposes, when I became a member of the University Air Squadron in Oxford in 42.
Can you remember why it was that you were drawn to the Air Force rather than to the Army or the Navy?
No. No. No, that's just one of those things that's shrouded in the mists of time, as far as I'm concerned.
Do you remember what you did in the University Air Squadron?
Yes, up to a point. I can remember assembling and disassembling complicated guns, one in particular whose name I forget, assault courses in the early morning, swinging over the river on ropes, the Charwell, that is, and not the Thames. Quite a bit of technical instruction, which was, of course, meant to prefigure a career as a pilot. Well, not a career as a pilot, but to be sport-time service as a pilot, like navigation and various technical things like that.
Did you, in fact, do any flying training while you were at Oxford?
Yes, a little bit. Yes, I used to be taken up in Tiger Moths, and I can remember cheerfully following the wrong railway line out of Oxford and in towards Berkshire in happy bliss, quite ignorant of the fact that it was the wrong railway line, but it didn't matter too much. And I quite enjoyed it. Even when we flew upside down over Blenheim Palace. That was quite enjoyable.
Was that on your initiative or the instructor's?
That was the instructor's initiative. Yes. It was quite exhilarating.
The early morning assault courses sound rather more like infantry training than Air Force training.
Yes, I suppose it was perfectionism, perhaps, on the part of the local squadron. I mean, Oxford University and all that. It's supposed to produce the very best, and it was highly competitive. And so we were required to get up in college at 7 o'clock, have our cold water jug and basin wash, and then get out pronto and shin up ropes and all the rest of it for half an hour or so at a time, cross the river on ropes, the smaller river. That's the Charwell.
Yes, the Thames would have been a little bit ambitious.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Did you think of volunteering for the Air Force as opposed to waiting for call-up?
No. No, I was... things happened to me. I was too young, really. I was immature, actually, when I look back on it, but I was too young. So things happened, and I let them happen.
What form did the call-up take? What were you asked to do when it arrived?
I was asked, after my fourth term at wartime Oxford, I think it was, to... report to St. John's Wood in London for attachment to the Air Force. The place, the actual cricket ground was used, or the outskirts of it were used for kitting us out and giving us the kit bags, and from there we marched off to our respective headquarters in St. John's Wood and that kind of area. But I was actually called up to do that in around about the 16th of December 1943. And as I was marching back to my base at Grove Court with my new kit bag and supplies, I began to feel extremely ill, and to cut a long and boring story short, I developed streptococcal pneumonia that very evening as a result of the epidemic that was then sweeping London and killing folks off left, right and centre. So I was in a delirious state, very, very ill, until Christmas Day in the Middlesex Hospital, and then they revived me and gave me some turkey and Christmas pudding, and I relapsed and very nearly died, they tell me, on Boxing Day. So to cut a long and boring story short, it was about the very end of January or early February before I was released from hospital.
I was going to ask you about the medical examination when you joined. Did you have a rigorous medical at St John's Wood, or was it a sketchy affair? Can you remember that?
Well, I think I probably fell ill before that happened, because I had no recollection of one whatsoever.
The hospital, the Middlesex Hospital, was this manned by its normal civilian staff?
Yes, it was.
So it wasn't a service hospital?
Not at all. No, it's a big, still exists, I think. So it's a big London civic hospital.
What happened to you then once you had recovered from your illness?
I was sent to a kind of transmission station at East Church on the Isle of Sheppey. I felt so ill after the pneumonia that I decided, with a little family pressure, that I could not continue with air crew, and therefore I switched. And that carried its own penalty at that time, so I could expect, though I didn't know it at the time, but I did get a pretty hard posting, first to the clearance camp, as it were, on the Isle of Sheppey, where I spent a week or so, three of them on detention for dirty buttons, on parade. And then I was posted to an Air Force camp called a maintenance unit at Harper Hill in Derbyshire, which must be one of the highest and bleakest military stations anywhere south of the border. It was, well, the top of Harper Hill was 1,400 feet, and I would think the camp was probably about 1,000 feet. I arrived in a blizzard. The countryside was deep in snow. So
just the thing for someone recovering from pneumonia.
For a convalescent, exactly. And the day after I got there, I remember vividly, I was wheeling smoke bombs with titanium tetrachloride in along a concrete causeway in a blizzard. So, not the ideal preparation.
You mentioned that you gave up aircrew. Does this mean that when you joined the Air Force you were committed to going into aircrew?
That was their expectation, yes.
So it was their expectation, not your decision?
Shall we put it that technically and legally it was my decision, but since I was then about, I must have been 17, I suppose, and it was not I don't know really what I can add to that. I was just extremely immature, I think.
Was it a presumption that they made because you'd done some flying training while you were at Oxford?
Yes, I think so. I think so. They were all extremely civil about it. And the whole unpleasant process passed off in a very gentlemanly fashion.
When you mention aircrew, were you thinking in terms of bomber crew or fighter aircraft? Had you?
I wasn't thinking.
You had no idea where you'd like to go?
No, it was just a generalised. I think the most powerful factor probably was that I had a lot of friends, and many of those were in the air squadron, so I joined them.
Presumably, though, you had some qualifications as a pilot by the time you left the air squadron.
Scarcely any, actually.
Had you flown solo by the time you...
No.
You hadn't?
No, not at all.
But you had done some flying with an instructor?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think a couple of outings. Once, I remember clearly, was upside down over Blenheim Palace.
You haven't mentioned doing any basic training once you were called up.
No, I didn't really have time, because I was called up one day, and then 2 days later I also, I was in hospital and out of it, and I was out of it for a full 6 weeks, I would think.
Yeah, but they didn't put you onto a basic training program once you came out of hospital. You went straight off to
transit camp. I had an interview at the end of my illness when I was convalescent, and I expressed my desire to change my route. And they were actually very understanding about it and agreed to it without demur. So it was after that things followed their own course, and of course I was in the what shall I say, the basic ground crew bracket.
What was the accommodation like at the Isle of Sheppey? What sort of place was it?
It was an exposed and at that time rather windy camp, which was simply a collection of mission huts. And I remember particularly the loos were on the top of a rise and did not encourage you, shall we say, to linger.
What was the food like?
Unmemorable.
And you mentioned that you got confined to barracks for having dirty buttons, being idle on parade. How did that happen?
Well, that was a simple one, really. I had actually cleaned these damn buttons the night before, but it was my ill fortune that we got a sea fret down, and we had to stand around on parade for a bit, and by the time I was inspected, I was below par. So it was a case of up you go, you know. But I had a friendly NCO who broke the detention with me and took me to the local glassworks in, I think it was a place called Queensborough on Sheppey. And we had a pleasant hour or two to relieve the monotony.
Doesn't sound as though it was that bad then.
No, it was. The Air Force was comparatively civilized, I'm biased, of course, at a lower level.
Now, the maintenance unit at Harper Hill.
Yes.
What does this mean? Was it maintenance in the sense of actually upgrading, repairing, and servicing equipment?
No, I don't think so. I think it may be a portmanteau term that covers a variety of Air Force camps, but this particular one was one that's was tunnelled into a limestone hillside, and it contained a large quantity of bombs and ammunition, which were being heavily called upon at this period, because of course it was not long, as I was later to discover, before D-Day.
So this is really maintenance in the logistics sense.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. I think so. There were high explosive bombs. There were poison gas bombs, mustard gas bombs, I can vouch for. There were smoke bombs, as I said. A whole armory stuffed into the mountain in tunnels. And, of course, the mountains being limestone, it was easy to excavate it. It's still... well, the tunnels are still there today. I believe they've used them for mushroom growing since then.
Again, what were the living conditions like there? You mentioned that it was the high altitude and it was blizzard when you arrived.
Yes, it was extremely severe when I arrived. It was not quite the ideal prescription after a bout of pneumonia. But as the spring wore on, it became rather pleasant because it was very splendid air and very healthy, and I used to go out walking over the fells when the work was over, when I could.
Did you have a routine working day?
Well, it's some time ago, but I do remember that a lot of time I spent on night duty, and I can remember that. That was a long period of night duty, actually, and mostly at that time I was engaged in stuffing, I think it was 303 ammunition into tin boxes and then sealing the lids, along with other folks in a large Nissen hut. It was factory-type work, really. Mm. But it was obviously important because it was coming up to D-Day, and no doubt these were going out to aerodromes around the place. Mm. So it was perfectly, what shall I say, well, you could call it tedious, but that, at that age, you just accepted these things and it bounced off your back, really.
Yeah.
But perhaps one of the most tedious aspects was having to chug across this barren limestone mountainside at midnight to get your baked beans, and then come back again until you finished at 6 or so in the morning.
Were they running a three-shift system?
Yes, I think they were. Yes, yes, they were.
Where were you living? Were you in a hut or something?
I was in a hut, yes, yes. No very clear memory of that. So it can't have been too bad.
Do you know how many of you there were in the hut?
No. Mm. Oh, I imagine it was the standard sort of 20, 24.
Mm. How did you get on with the other people in the hut?
That was rather a curiosity because, of course, as an Oxford undergraduate, I spoke rather differently from the majority, and I can remember being seriously asked if I was from a member of the aristocracy by one or two of the others. Well, in a friendly enough way, very respectful-like, but... So not at all unpleasant, but rather strange.
Because for many young men, it would be their first really dramatic social mixing, wouldn't it?
Yes.
To go into the services.
I can remember that one of the chaps I spoke to most often was a chap from the West Country, Southwest Country, Dorset, I think. I think he's probably from an agricultural labouring background because there was a considerable gulf in perceptions of life, but he was a nice enough chap.
Mm.
An attraction of opposites, perhaps, from that point of view.
How long were you at Harper Hill?
I reckon probably... I can only... It's a long time ago, but I would think I wouldn't be far out if I said from early February 44... until somewhere just around about or before, I can't quite remember, D-Day.
Mm.
So that would have been June, wouldn't it? In
6th of June.
Yes. Mm. So I'm not absolutely clear when I was posted from there, but most of that time was spent on those jobs.
Mm.
And it was interrupted again by illness because after the pneumonia I managed to collect a bout of quinsy, which kept me off for a while. But I recovered from that, fortunately.
Did you have to have hospital treatment for that, or were
no,
you?
No, I was carefully monitored by service approved doctors at home.
Mm.
Mm.
Did the posting just arrive out of the blue, or did you have any prior?
Came out of the blue. It was preceded by rumours among some of my colleagues, and I was about to be posted to Iceland. Oh. That turned out to be incorrect. Do you want me to repeat it?
No, carry on. How were you told that you were being posted? What happened?
It's a distant memory, but I must have been summoned to the station's administrative HQ, I think, and told by one of the officers there.
Did you see much of officers while you were at Harper's Hill?
Very little. Very little. Yes, need I say more?
Was there anything to do there in the way of recreation when you weren't actually working?
Not a thing. So I made my own recreation by walking over the fells and exploring the district when I could, which was delightful, fortunately, and it helped to keep me sane.
Where were you sent to then for your posting from Harper's Hill?
I'm sorry?
Where were you sent to? Where was your posting?
Oh, well, from there, the rumour had been that I was going to Iceland, but in fact, I was going to the Orkney Islands, so somebody had nearly got it right.
What did they tell you? Did you have any detailed idea where you were going, what you were going to be doing when you were given your posting order?
No, not at all. I went absolutely with a blank sheet.
How did you actually get up there?
Oh, it must have been on a rail warrant. Yes, it was a rail warrant, travelling via Perth and the way up to the small port where the Cameroonian Highlanders had a transit camp where they fed you nice fat sausages before you took the ferry to Orkney. And then, of course, by ferry to Orkney.
Was it a smooth crossing?
No.
What happened when you arrived?
Well, it's a vague memory. It's a vague memory. There was a rumour, I can remember, that the Germans were about to land, but this was utter nonsense. And it was probably some jackass's notion of a practical joke, you know, the new arrival. They said, oh, yes, well, they'll be issuing you with Sten guns. But they never did, of course. It was total, well, I could use a military word,
crap. Mm. What were you actually doing then once you got there? And
yes, well, I must have got there, I suppose, in mid-1944.
Yeah.
And I was there until certainly at least the end of 1945. So that's pretty well an 18-month period. And I was trained in the duties of a clerk, special duties. The clerk special duties. Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Shall I continue?
Yes.
So a clerk special duties was, it turned out, somebody who worked in an operations room and plotted the course of aircraft with magnetized metallic arrows in accordance with instructions received through a headphone. So I can't quite remember whether I got the training for that on the spot. I must have done, I think.
Well, you've learned on the job.
Yes, yes, I think so. It wasn't a difficult job, but it was quite an important one because, of course, in Orkney we were designated to guard Scapa Flow, which was, of course, the base of the whole fleet. And, of course, the eastern side of the Scapa Flow had been sealed off by concrete emplacements after the sinking of the battleship in the first year of the war.
The Royal Oak.
Yes, in the western side. So they sealed off the eastern side with the causeway, which, as far as I know, is still there.
Where was the ops room located?
It was about 3 miles or so east of the chief town of Orkney, which was Kirkwall.
Was it in a purpose-built building?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Yeah. It was a place called Grimsetter, or Grimster, as the locals called it. And, of course, we used to be ferried by military coach to our work there and back again. And again, it was a case of doing shift duties sometimes, quite often. I think the day was divided up into three. And I can remember doing a lot of night shifts again.